read some chapters of the Linux kernel book.
Okay.
Trying to understand again how is the interruptions handled and so on.
Uh-huh.
So it turns out that now I'm convinced you were right. I mean, this completion is done in the bottom half.
Mm.
The completion event is logged in the bottom
by block trace.
By the block layer.
Mm.
So yeah, so the thing is, is not very, I would say, realistic, right? Well, I mean, there's some difference when actually the request was done. Yeah. So I saw the difference is more or less. I saw a couple of these cases was more or less 60 microseconds.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be important for us, I guess.
But how did you measure the difference?
With the block trace, right? So the idea is that, another thing that I did was to recompile the kernel.
Mm.
I eliminate the preemption from the kernel. I reduce the time slice, I increase the frequency of the tick by to 1,000 hertz, something like that. I don't remember. So I use the lowest click time you can use in the kernel.
Mm-hmm. So this tick time reduces the time slice?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because each time this clock hits the CPU with an interruption is when the scheduler is activated. So
okay.
Makes sense too. Also, I guess. Well, anyway, okay. So I tried that.
Mm-hmm.
I did something else. I think that was mostly it. Okay, so I tried that. Oh, and I set the scheduler to be no op. So now I have a piece of very likely to have exactly the request that I sent to the device.
But it might include merging.
It might include merging. But it's unlikely because it's random, right? So so it's very unlikely.
Mm.
Okay, so given all that, then the traces look something like this. So the first two events are D events. I'm talking about D and C events only.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm completely removing the rest of the events. So the first two D events, the first two are D events. Okay, so there is no completion in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing. And after the second D, you have a C of the first D.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that means that the second D is sent exactly in the moment the disk sends an interruption saying the first request is done.
Yeah.
And you...
Which makes sense, because the reason for the top half to execute synchronously at the time of the interrupt is so that after processing the interrupt in the top half, the disk can be busy immediately again.
Right.
So send the next request, whatever it was. And therefore you see D event, the first two D events, consecutively.
Right. And it makes sense. I mean, and you want to also free the CPU of the handler as quickly as you can, right?
Yeah, you make the disk busy and then free the CPU.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, so I guess in this, after you have your request in the disk, now you do what is called this tasklet or something like that,
mm-hmm.
Tasklet, where you give a function so that the handler is or the interruption is handled in a later time.
Mm.
Still with an interruption context.
Mm.
Right. Okay. So I think what is happening is that the C event is logged in this tasklet, which is the bottom half of
which
it.
We could use for the D event also, right? Because the C event is processed in the top half, we could use the time of the C event as the
D.
the time of the D event as
the
time,
completion
of time of the previous one.
That's what I did. So because, okay, so we're doing asynchronous IO, right? Which means that most of the time, at least that's what we think, is that we have the queue filled of requests all the time. So so what I thought is, okay, so now I just will measure the difference between all the Ds I have, right, and plot that. So it turns out that it gives me more or less the same results.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there are some interesting things, right? So, for instance, the first thing is that there is no request lower than 100 microseconds.
All requests are above 100
microseconds.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
The
and average.
This 100 microseconds was computed by using the top half completion time.
The top half. Yeah.
Okay. So not.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's safe because because this is the D events, right? Mm-hmm. And the D events, at least most of them, are happening at the top half. So well, I'm guessing the first one is not at the top half because, you know, you don't have any interruption from the disk, but the rest should be should be from the top. So it's 100 microseconds.
Mm.
I don't know exactly what that means.
These are reads or writes?
These are writes. These are writes. So
this is with the which device?
Memorite. Yeah.
And this, how big are the write requests?
4K.
So these are page writes or maybe
page
two
writes.
Page writes. Either one page or two page, right?
Right.
Depending on internal
page. Depending on the page size of the device.
It's sort of in the right range, which is hundreds of microseconds.
Right.
For write.
Yeah, but you know, it could be that also that. Well, what I see is that the first 26 requests are in the line of 100 microseconds. After that, you see an increase, but you also see some variation. So there are some request that goes down again to 100 microseconds and again.
Depending on if there is probably a clean block right away to write.
Right.
Or if you have to wait for some cleaning again.
Yeah, but the thing is that 26 requests of 4K is not much, right? I guess, you know, with 26 requests, you're not actually feeding the whole free or spare blocks you have in the device. So that's weird.
Yeah, remember that you don't need to fill up all the free space. You just need to reach some sort of threshold of clean blocks.
That's true.
To start the cleaning.
That's
maybe
true.
that threshold is really, really small.
Okay, could be. Yeah, why not?
And one thing which you might want to see is that if you get the same sort of behavior with the other devices, or if with the other devices there is much more latency before the variation starts.
Right. So I guess if it's happening at the top half of an interruption handler, there is no way the scheduler is making some or is interfering with, you know,
no.
With this, right?
There is no way.
I mean, it's always
immediate. Yes.
So one thing I was trying to do, you know, by general for all the projects is trying to look for the interruption handler in the kernel and put the C event there. But I couldn't find it. Because that, will give us a better, timing. Right?
The thing is with the top half, so remember that device drivers have two components. One is a device specific component,
uh-huh.
And the device generic component.
Okay.
So the device specific component, I'm assuming, is the top half.
Right.
Because it needs to know exactly what kind of controller it is talking to.
Right.
So it can extract things like state and so on. And the device generic component is the IO completion handler.
Like the block layer.
Like the block layer stuff.
Okay.
So that is could be one reason why you cannot find a single position to insert your completion.
Yeah, no, I know that. And in fact, I was looking for the interruption handler. It's in the device driver. So.
Mm.
So I guess that would mean that you have to change that in all the device drivers. And I guess that's the reason why it's about the block layer, because the block layer is independent of the device driver. But even that I was, you know, trying to find this interruption handler, at least for the machine I'm using, and trying to do this, like
yeah.
put the sieve in there instead. Maybe that could help us.
Yeah, it can
make us more confident on the result.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it can certainly help. If yeah, okay. So the experiment that you were doing is the random writes.
I was doing the random writes. So what I have for now is this line that I found this 1 hour ago or so, about 100 microseconds, which is interesting because I thought. Well, I guess 100 microseconds means that the writes are absorbed by the
write buffer.
By the write buffer, right?
Possibly.
Now
it could also be that the writes of the first 28 writes are being absorbed in the write buffer, and
mm-hmm.
then there is no more space.
Right.
Then you have to write flush something to the device, and that's why you start seeing the variability.
Yeah, could be. Yeah.
And if that may be the reason, I mean, the other thing, how much is the variability that you see?
It's big. So, okay, so the meantime, I did this for a very small
mm-hmm.
experiment, so it was 10,000 requests, right? So actually, you won't see what we want to see, but it's this
mm-hmm.
drop in the response, in the throughput or increase in the response time. But so in these 10,000 was, the average response time was 1 millisecond.
1 millisecond.
1 millisecond, more or less. It was like 108 milliseconds or so.
That seems like what you would have when you have an erase operation.
Yeah.
So it seems like on an average you have maybe either one erase operation or half an erase operation.
Right.
To lead you to
so
1 millisecond.
So for each 2 requests you have 1 erase. That's what you're saying.
Something like that.
Right.
For 10,000 requests.
Yeah,
so your 10,000 request average is 1 millisecond, right? But then your first 28 requests are 100 microseconds, and
mm-hmm.
then you start in changing, varying.
Mm-hmm.
Is the varying constant for the remaining 10,000 requests, or after some time the variation increases even more?
Well, I guess it's pretty small, right? So I don't know. 10,000 is not much, I guess. But no, actually, it keeps in the same range, and I would say that the range is between 100 microseconds and 10 milliseconds, sort of. Yeah.
So there is no sort of gradual degradation of the response?
No, I haven't seen that so far.
Yeah.
The other thing which I wanted to ask is the write buffering. Based on the serial ATA driver, were you able to switch off the write buffering and somehow confirm that the write buffering is off?
No, I haven't been able to confirm that. What I have seen so far is that having the, at least what HD Farm says, right?
Mm-hmm.
Having the write buffer off or on give me exactly the same result.
Okay.
So
it could be that the write buffering is not able to turn off.
Probably, yeah. But even when I query the device, asking for the this AC farm, right? Asking for the write buffer, it says that it's off.
I think there would be one simple experiment to do which will allow you to test that. Is to do just 2 write requests. One with the write buffer on and the other with the write buffer off. And you do this several times to take the average when the write buffer is on and when the write buffer is off.
Right. Okay.
And
okay.
See if there any difference. You're saying that there is no difference in your overall results, but what about single requests?
Single requests. Right, so what I can do is to keep the same block again and again for some number of times with
you don't have to use the same block.
Is your midterm exam?
It should be, yes. Where does that come from?
The copy machine.
Oh, okay.
You were saying? So, right, so, no, what I was saying is that to hit the same, because if you have the write buffer on,
mm.
then if you hit the same block again and again, you will update that in the buffer itself.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you will update it in the media, right?
Mm. Oh, I see what you mean. That depends on whether the write buffer is enabled or disabled, right?
Mm-hmm.
If the write buffer is enabled, it doesn't matter which data you write to. It will be buffered, right?
Yeah, but the thing is that if you do it random, then at some point you have to flush something from the buffer, and you will have exactly the same results that we have now.
Mm, I see what you mean. Mm.
So
yeah, that makes sense.
You need to
write to the same location.
Write to the same location.
Okay, yeah. So if you can do a simple test to verify the write, whether, I mean, that's going to be one of the biggest things, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is the write buffer on or not? And that will either make us interpret results in one way or a completely different way.
Yeah.
So if we have an answer to that question, it will certainly help.
Yeah.
Okay, so there is some, so right now you, I mean, what you're saying is you have a graph which looks like 100 microseconds, let's say 100. You have something like this, and then you have, after a very short period of time, you have wide variance.
Yeah, exactly.
For continuously for a long time.
Yeah, exactly.
And these are 4K
random writes to memory.
Okay.
Oh, I have
What do you have?
I have some notes of the friend meeting here.
That's good.
Is
there anything interesting there?
No, the only thing is that we need to make a case for a new model.
Mm.
Other than the trade-offs papers. That there is a big interest in rights.
Mm. Okay, so, I mean, one thing which we should do is also do the same experiment but with sequential rights.
Okay.
And see what you get.
Okay. Yeah, so I guess, well, so I don't know if we can trust of this measurement between D and D. I don't know if there could be cases where the Q is empty. So I think I was trying to have this completion time in the device driver itself. Because I'm not sure that the queue will be always full, right?
Uh-huh.
That will depend on the scheduler and
I agree. If you can get that would confirm our know for sure the times are okay. But if not, then it's fine. I think as long as you keep the queue non-empty, this assumption should be okay.
Yeah, but the problem is, how not to keep the queue or to keep the queue non-empty, because that depends on the scheduler. I mean, the thing is that if you have 20 requests,
mm-hmm.
right, then probably all the requests are serviced,
mm-hmm.
and the scheduler have. They give you the chance to put some more requests
mm-hmm.
to queue, right? So in that case, our assumption is messed up.
That's true. Yeah. So I agree. If you can get the right monitoring of the completion events, that would help.
Also, I haven't seen. I don't know what I changed exactly, but in this set of experiments that I did lately, there was no this burst of requests that I had before. Remember that? That I have a bunch of these and then a bunch of C's. So right now it's not happening. Right now you have D, C, D, C, D, C, D, C.
So, bunch of D's and then letters.
Yeah, before I had previous...
Now the D events are the issue events, right?
Right.
Now you're looking at issue of the file system or the issue by the device?
No, the issue to the device driver.
To the device.
From device driver to device. So before I had a burst
of
D's and then a burst of C. But for some reason now I have all D and C. D and C. As it should be, I guess. Oh, I see. Probably what I changed is that now I only stop writing or queuing requests when I don't have enough memory. And before I have a limit in the number of requests.
So now you have more requests in the
queue? Now I have as much requests as the memory can queue.
In the queue?
In the queue.
I don't think that's the reason. I feel that the reason is because of the time slice.
That I decrease the time slice?
The time slice, that's
right.
Where the bottom half gets to execute before the next interrupt arrives.
Right.
In previously, your bottom half wouldn't run. You would have multiple interrupts,
mm-hmm.
which all dequeue events.
Right, right.
And then you run the bottom
half. Okay. So then this change that I made of making the kernel non-preemptible is not good, right? Actually, have to make it preemptible. Because one of the things I changed in the kernel was to make the kernel non-preemptible. So, I guess based...
Well, non-preemptible just means that you cannot have two system calls simultaneously.
Right.
That's what it means. But you can have interrupts and system and...
You will have interrupts anyway.
Anyway.
Yeah, but my point is that... now if you have a long system call, then even if the timer blocks interrupt, your user process won't.
So if there is some other process,
there
is some other process in the system that
system, exactly.
That is doing a system call unrelated to your experiment.
Unrelated to my experiment, exactly. Could affect
the
assumption we're making. Okay.
Now you can check if you make this kernel preemptive, do you get the same results or do you get like burst of D's and burst of C's maybe?
Yeah.
Hmm. Okay, interesting. So at least there is a change in status.
Yeah. Yeah. So I just want to make sure that we keep the device busy all the time, because otherwise we cannot, our assumptions in the experiment is not good, right? We need to be sure that
The cleaning does not...
That the cleaning does not have the time to clean.
Yeah. Okay, So what I would suggest is go ahead with this experiment, and if you can send us a graph of the timeline for the other two devices also, I think that would help.
Okay.
And then maybe you can do one with a sequential to see if there is any change.
Okay.
Then do you plan to increase the size of the request?
That's one possibility I was thinking about, and I found there was some problem with that. So, my problem is that in that case, if you increase the size of request, then you will have sequential writes to the blocks. And that means that you will have more switch merges.
That is what we want to see, right? I mean, we want to observe how the cleaning efficiency changes as you change the request pattern.
Yeah.
With a random write, you might have a different cleaning efficiency than a sequential write. Mm-hmm. In case of sequential write, maybe you have more switch merges than partial or full merges. And similarly, with larger requests, you might have more partial merges or switch merges than full merges. So I think it would be good to have
the same experiment for sequential
and with different request sizes.
That makes sense. Yeah.
For us to understand better what is the dependence on these different patterns of access, sequential versus random, and varying request size. And then we can see whether our model is able to predict each of these different patterns or not. And I mean, like we have here, there are two different levels maybe, and maybe more than two levels, mm-hmm. like 100 microseconds and some other levels in mm-hmm. between. Are there any distinct levels that you see?
No, I haven't seen any distinct levels, just random. Well, at least that's what I see, right? Random. But, you know, it's just a matter of see the details, because I actually found these 26 requests because I just start, you know, zooming to these spaces, you know, closer.
Otherwise, you might have missed it.
Yeah, otherwise I would miss it, totally.
And then there is no pattern complete. It's totally random in the remaining.
Well,
or is there a distinct band? Do you see a distinct band with a boundary? Or
no, I didn't see any band. Hmm. I would say, but the only thing that I thought was interesting is that after some time, there is another small band of 100 microsecond requests and go up again. You know, something like you have your line at the beginning, random, line again, and random.
So you have something like
a small line there, and random again, exactly.
Again.
Something like that. That's probably another pattern there. Okay. So.
I wonder what's going on there.
Probably I can check if that, you know, repeats. So you can check why. Is that the case?
Okay. So what else should we talk about today? Are there any other agenda items?
No, actually that's what we have for today. I think we need to work on the write model in parallel with this. But that's all. I haven't done anything with the write model yet. Yeah. So I guess that's all for today. So yeah.
Now the write model, I mean, based on the DFTL paper, is there a reason for us to re-examine our current write model to take into account explicitly the cost of partial merge versus full merge?
Just before getting into that, it's a different topic. I have like two or three comments for the experiments.
Mm-hmm.
I think like the write buffer, it might be perhaps better to just rely on the steady state that we discussed in the past, similarly to what happened in the RAID paper,
mm-hmm.
In order to make the results comparable across multiple devices.
Mm.
Maybe the case that in some devices we'll be able to disable
the RAID buffer.
In some others we will not. But in the end, what I see is that we are only going to change the first part of the curve, where the buffer is taking effect into response time. So other than that, I mean, we expect to see variance in the behavior in the response time after we achieve this steady state, right?
Yes.
So maybe I would say it's secondary issue to consider this right buffer. I mean, to do the experiments.
In a way, it's a bit connected to what we are doing. Is because if, let's say if the right buffer were disabled, then we can see that the 100 microseconds is the right latency in the presence of a clean block, right? If the write buffer was enabled, then the 100 microsecond is very likely just writing to the buffer and getting a response back. It's not writing to the flash. It's not write latency anymore to actual flash media. So that there is some sort of a connection. If we go to a steady state where there is no effect of the write buffer, then we also combine the effects of probably cleaning. I mean, is there a way to separate out cleaning writes versus non-cleaning writes?
That is actually my second point.
Okay.
And before executing this experiment, since in this particular case you are saying that there's random behavior after this 26 requests, and there's no visible curve or anything that we expect to see from this kind of steady degradation in the response time, that depends definitely on the state of the device, right? So I think the one key aspect is to make sure that we start in a known state, and from the various type of known states we can define. One is that we have all the blocks erased for us. So the question is if we can force the device to get to that state by some mechanism. So we are sure that all the blocks are available.
All the free blocks are clean.
Or the log blocks.
Or the log blocks are erased.
Are erased, correct.
Yeah.
So then we may have better chance to see this steady degradation. I don't know if it's possible to get to that state before starting this experiment on any device.
Even if it were possible to get to that state, we have to verify that we are in that state, right? That's another question. So we can create some model of the cleaning and say, based on this request pattern, we force the device in that state, but then we have to verify that the device is in fact in that state. And then the next question is, how do we verify state? So one thing which I was thinking was, we write to the entire device sequentially from beginning to end. Maybe that will force the device into some known state. And probably with that sort of a write pattern, we have all the log blocks getting cleaned. Maybe write twice to the entire device from beginning to end sequentially.
Right, but if we are executing writes, you are saying, I'm using the entire capacity of the device, right? So, and in other words, I'm saying that everything is occupied or used. So, I think we want the other way around.
Well, actually, you can by no way force the state of the device where every block is clean, because you don't know the state of the device ahead of time. When it comes from the manufacturer, some of the blocks will already be written into for testing purpose, whatever it is. Right? So when you get the device itself, it is very likely that there are some unclean blocks in there. And then the question is, how do we trigger the cleaning operation, which will allow us to enter into some known state? You trigger a cleaning operation by doing right. That's the only way, right? That's why I said that maybe one way is to just fight sequentially to the entire, to entire space, and maybe that is some known state. Maybe it's a state where you do not have all blocks which are clean, only some blocks which are clean. But if it is a state that I can force the device into always, if I do sequential write for the entire device, it might still be a valuable state because it's at least consistent each time. I think for devices that are not completely in your control, I mean, if you don't manufacture it, you don't really know what's in there already.
Right.
You don't know the state of the device when you purchase it. So you have to do something extra to maybe force it into a state. And if you do that, you get in the same state. It's like an idempotent operation. Each time you do something, you get the same result. Do something, you get the same result. And starting from that state, if you do certain experiment, you will get the same result again because the beginning state is the same.
Right, that's, that's basically the point. I mean, in order to avoid some randomness in behavior.
Yeah, but it's, so we could do something like write to the entire device sequentially. Before each experiment, that will force the device into some state where, I don't know if that is, first of all, whether that will be effective, and second, whether it's necessary. I think the second question is, should be answered first. How critical it is to have a consistent beginning state for our experiments, especially if you're going to look at steady state performance. Maybe if you're looking at steady state performance, the starting state is not so critical.
Right, but I was making the case of the steady degradation of the response time, right, as you populate more and more the SSD.
Mm.
Right, so...
As you write to the SSD more and more. Populating the SSD cannot be controlled, right? Because we know when you buy the SSD, it is already populated because of all kinds of testing that they do.
Mm-hmm.
They write to the device. They have to do that. There's no other way to test it except to actually use the device.
Yeah, most of the devices go through this aging stage, stage where they actually use the device for some hours and they do the Q&A and things.
Yeah, maybe they have a way to erase all the blocks once they use it. I don't know if they do that. Maybe some devices do that, some others don't.
I think they do because I have seen some blocks where there are people complaining about the Intel device. So apparently, at the beginning, the Intel, when it's new, the Intel device is very good. But while you use it in time, the performance goes down.
We should use this reference in our paper to motivate why profiling is important.
Yeah,
right? Because
that's
true. Simple models do not really tell all the story.
So these people complain, and apparently there is a software that's one thing I was thinking while you were discussing this. There's a software that is able somehow it's able to put the Intel device in its fresh state again, which means that it can erase all the blocks, right?
Right. There is actually
maybe not erase all the blocks, but do something that will force the device into its initial state.
Right,
but they said, they said that after you use this, you will lose all your data in the SSD, right?
Yeah.
So
that's basically a command that's called print. It is available in some devices. I think Intel is one of those. SanDisk, I think it also supports those commands.
So you're talking about the same software?
The same. No, not really. I don't know the software. I've read that there's such commands that you can issue against the device, and the device will... you are just indicating that
block
is not used anymore from the user's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
So the SSD can go ahead and clean or reclaim that space and basically bring the lock into the eraser state.
Hmm.
So, but not all the SSDs support such command.
Yeah. Could you look into that software a bit more?
Yeah.
Find what exactly
it's it's a Windows software, so, but, yeah, I can find.
Maybe there are some details about the software, what it does.
Yeah, but the that's the other thing I thought, probably the dream command is the, what they use.
Hmm.
Should be, yeah.
The other thing which I wanted to,
but as far as I read, there was no device that support Trim yet, because the argument is that no operating system is using the Trim, and there is no device driver that uses the Trim command. So that's what I saw. You know, not even Intel has the
implementation
of the Trim.
Yeah, well, I guess
this is a very new introduction to the command set, I think.
It could be, yeah, it could be.
Yeah.
I read in the SanDisk paper that I sent a link some time ago for the some aspects of the right model,
mm-hmm.
for some key important aspects. And one of the suggestions was actually to implement or to use this command where available.
Mm.
Yeah, having that command would be great, I think.
So I was also thinking, should we get the Intel device?
Getting the Intel device could be very interesting. I guess the Intel device would be good to... I think there is quite a few information. It's, there are a lot of people using it and talking about that device.
Mm-hmm.
And also support NTQ, right? That could be interesting for us in terms of profiling, right?
Yeah.
So probably would make our lives easier in some, I don't know. But I think, yeah, it would be interesting.
Okay, yeah.
It's number three, just a single paragraph. If you...
Yes, I'm aware of the Trim command. This was something that was discussed at the SSD BOF in FAST. Virtually non-existent 2008, but is expected to grow with newer releases of OSs over the next several years.
Yeah.
And I think there is a general agreement that Trim is a great idea.
Yeah.
Because this is a very important piece of information that the SSD can use very effectively to improve its set of clean blocks
to proactively do the cleaning.
But the thing is that I think that Trim command is already in the ATA or CIPA specification. So I guess the only thing they have to do is implement it in the firmware, right?
Hmm.
But well, I guess
I'm not sure if it already exists in the specification. I think it is a new introduction.
It's a new introduction. Yeah. What I thought is that it was part of the specification already, and I thought the problem was how to use that information, right? Because it's not, I mean, although it's a good information to have inside the firmware, it's not easy
to use
to know how to use it, right?
For the disk drive, but in case
for
of SSD, it's very obvious.
Yeah, but in case of the SSD, well, what I'm saying is that in case of the SSD, probably it's not obvious, right? You can do.
It is, because if the file system can say these are all the free blocks. I freed a whole, let's say file got removed,
mm-hmm.
large file, video file, 3 gigabytes. Then the file system can say, well, these are all free. I don't need the data on these blocks on these sectors anymore. Now all those sectors are mapped internally to some physical blocks, and the SSD can then use those clean or erase those physical blocks and use them as log blocks.
Right.
Now you have a larger pool of log blocks, suddenly, maybe twice as many as you had before.
Right.
And you can have better write performance in the intermediate.
Okay.
Okay, so, yeah, so maybe we should get the Intel thing.
Probably it's a good idea. Yeah.
Because so far we have Memorite and then the SanDisk.
We have Memorite and the Samsung.
Yeah.
That I found that I don't know what happened, but the Samsung of 64 gig is not working.
It's not working.
Yeah, it's not working for some reason. I don't know why. I don't think it's the experiments, right? Because I think so.
It's not working.
SoC to support 1 meter wave block.
So what we can do is check with Gil if he can return it and get a replacement. So you're sure that it's not working?
Yeah, I'm sure it's not working.
Okay, then I'll send an email to Gil to find out about warranty issues.
Okay. So we have we have the two Samsung SanDisk and Memorite. We have one Entrum that I couldn't use because of some restriction in the request side. You remember? And that's all we have.
That's because of the device driver for the Entrum.
No, actually, it's all because the device driver is the same, right? It's the same controller.
Mm.
So, I think it's a restriction of the firmware
inside
the Entrum. So I don't know what is the restriction, but they have this restriction of a maximum request size of 128K.
So maybe we can still use it for some partial experiments.
Absolutely, yeah. Probably for this experiment,
can
we work.
Yeah. Okay.
But okay. I think that device is used by George right now.
Entrum?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the only one.
Did you tell him that it cannot support more than 128?
Yeah, but I guess he doesn't care. I don't know. I told him.
Okay, so let's continue the experiments with the right sequential random and increasing request.
And I also want to do the other experiment, but this experiment where you wait for some gap and start again. But the problem is that if we don't have the result for this one, it doesn't make sense to do the other one. Right?
When you say we don't have the results for this one,
for the random write, when I say results, I mean that we don't have this degradation in the response time we were expecting. But probably these are the results.
It could be. Let's try with the other devices and see what we
get. Okay, yeah, that's also a good idea.
Okay, so...
DFTL,
yeah. How does our write model change given the DFTL paper? And maybe with some new knowledge gained from that paper. There is this idea of differentiating between partial merges and full merges. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Because earlier with our understanding was just switch merge versus full merge. Now they introduced this partial merge where you choose a victim and you just need to copy data from that victim and merge it with some log block. You don't need to merge with several blocks, right? So partial merges are less expensive than these full merges, whereby you choose a victim log block that can contain data pages from several data blocks. And you might have to access several data blocks and several log blocks to actually free this victim log block. So that's a full merge. Now, so the question is, our write model was earlier, I think, based on only the assumptions of switch merge and partial merge. We weren't really thinking about all the complexities, or at least I wasn't thinking about all the complexities that you may encounter when you have like a full merge which touches so many different blocks. And so I guess the question is, what should we do with the write model? And how, if at all, we should change?
Well, that makes the second part of the equation for the base case.
Mm.
We have two main parts, right? So one is the actual write latency, which can account for the amplification, possible amplification that may happen. And then the second is the merge time,
mm.
right, which is separated in two parts.
You mean the cleaning time?
The cleaning time, right. So I think I have the expansion for that equation somewhere here. Yeah, we said that, right, so it was expanded into two components. One was the merge time. This merge time could be any of the three cases now, I mean, including the partial merge. And then we have the erase time.
What was that? The switch time?
Yeah, so no, this is not valid anymore.
Okay.
These are.
So this is decomposing these two?
In these two. Right, so this,
okay,
this
so
is like
the
large time.
Okay.
So this merge time, which basically requires the reading, possibly from multiple blocks, and then the erase time for all the blocks involved as well.
Mm.
If you need to incur in any erase.
No, but in the case of the I mean, you don't have to wait for the erase of the other guys. You only have to, of the other blocks, you only have to read from them, right? I mean, you have to wait only for one erasure.
Hmm. But those times are optional, right? So this means that not always you will incur in those costs.
Hmm.
It depends on some magical, you know, distribution or probabilistic model, maybe that can tell us. I mean, yes, we need to do this erase time. We're going to incur into this cost because the device is in this state, and most likely we will hit. So that part's not modeled.
Hmm.
That's I think the most complex part of this, right, to
model the merging and erase cost. I think what Lewis was saying is that for the erase cost, we can assume that you always need to erase only one block before you can start writing your data. As soon as you erase one block, you are ready to go. You might be able to erase other blocks also because of the merge operation, but the write request does not have to wait for all the erases. It just needs to wait for one erase operation. Which seems reasonable, though FTL may be very dumb. Right? The firmware may be really dumb and say, now I have all these blocks that are clean, let me erase all of them and then do whatever is needs to be done next.
Yeah,
right?
That's a possibility, but I don't think so.
That's not how you would implement it, but
yeah.
It depends on what is easy to implement, right? I mean,
that's true. Yeah.
If postponing and resuming is easier than doing it synchronously, I think doing it synchronously is easier. So we don't know how the firmware is implemented. Maybe the SSD guys are all smart programmers and they know how to do this. But you're right. In general, the amount of erase latency is not clear and typically should not be more than one block. Because as soon as you erase the first block, you have space to write.
Yeah, exactly.
And you should write at that point. And then later on, maybe erase more blocks that get free because of the merge operation, right? So maybe we can say that the erase cost is constant. That is one block erase time. But the merge cost can be is a variable.
As many as pages in a block.
As much as zero, which in case of switch merge, right? Or it could be, you know, many pages, many blocks of merging activity that is needed. In case of a partial merge, you always, the merge cost is proportional to a single block, right? But the amount of data that you need to read out depends on the valid information in that block, right? So that's certainly something that is a variable factor even within the partial merge, depending on the number of valid pages per block. And in case of full merge, it's even more variable because it also depends on the number of blocks that are involved in the merge operation. So the merge cost is something that can get fairly complex.
And maybe even the erase time, erase cost, I mean, like we may fall in oversimplification if we say it's only one erase time that we need to do. Because like in the full merge case, in the worst case for the DSTL paper, we saw that I mean, if we choose one log block as a victim, then we may need to write data blocks for other blocks as well elsewhere, and that may incur an additional erase costs. Because it might be the case that also those blocks, that's those chosen victim blocks, are as well in the same situation, and then you have this cascading effect.
So what you're saying is that the merge operation itself might trigger an erase requirement.
Extra erase
requirement, because you have to write data out from those blocks somewhere else, and there might be no space to write.
Right.
Even so.
No. What was that again? Are you understand that?
Like in the case of the DSTL, I mean, they actually place a figure for explaining that case, right, where you have a log block which is chosen as a victim, and this contains valid pages from other data blocks.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to erase, but those valid pages you need
to merge them,
save somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
But then the original data blocks.
Oh, I see. Okay, I remember that. So now you need to erase that. Erase some other block in order to be able to merge the valid data with some other valid data.
Right, you do the merge and you need that information to write
elsewhere. That's true, yeah, that's true.
I think that's the reason the cleaning happens on a threshold, that you always have some extra blocks that are clean at any time available, so that the worst case latency for a write operation is bound by a certain value. That is proportional to the merge cost in the worst case, which is a full merge. To do the merge operation, you assume that there are already clean blocks that exist that can absorb all those writes. And then you erase the block to bring back your clean block threshold to the right value, and you can go ahead and write. So certainly we are making a whole bunch of assumptions, right? I mean, of how the firmware algorithms work in terms of cleaning. Now, the question is whether we can come up with a model that's reasonably accurate despite these assumptions.
Mm-hmm. In general, enough maybe, because, you said, I mean, different vendors are going to implement firmware in a different way, and maybe some more skilled programmers are going to do it in a different, more efficient way. But they're also constrained by budget, right? So, I mean, if they need to implement more complex logic, that will require more sophisticated circuitry and that type of thing, which they may not be planning to put in the device, so they simplify it in a way, I mean, consciously. So, but this, the model, then has to be general enough to say, I mean, to cover the majority of the cases for the devices we are experimenting.
Yeah.
Probably we can do the model general by having some variables, something similar to what we have in Reeds, right? So I think that the Reed model is good and it's just general, because we are extracting some values from the SSD in order to be able to construct the model. So probably if we can do something like that in the right model, that could make the model more general. I don't know exactly how, but the idea is that if we know key things about the SSD and how it writes, then we can get those parameters and feed that into the model, and then have an accurate time of response time that the DSP can give you in the right. Something like that.
Yeah, that makes sense at some abstract level, yes. That you populate the model based on some additional experiments.
Right. That's what we are doing with the reads, right? I mean, with the reads, we are extracting these stride size based on that stride size when we say, okay, this is our read performance.
Okay. All right, so I think it might be a good idea for us to also, in simultaneously with the experiments, also make progress on the right model. Maybe we can talk a little bit more about the how to deal with the merge model. Right. I think the merge model, as we discussed today, seems like it can get fairly complex. But maybe there is a way to formalize it.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think, well, also Professor Jason, I mean, was suggesting some time ago to use this queuing model, I mean, to look at the devices as some type of service, say, and then we have like some requests waiting,
mm-hmm.
and they are going to incur in some costs as they are
mm-hmm.
served for the right part, especially.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so I think that direction, I think, is also interesting for including into this model some probabilistic model.
Mm-hmm. So the queuing model would assume that there are multiple requests that are outstanding, and then you derive queuing time and service time,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah. That may be something worth pursuing. At this point, I guess we are just looking at a single write request, right? And just one write request, how to model that, rather than a stream of write requests. If I think once we address the single write request modeling, then maybe we can move to the multiple sequence of
mm-hmm.
write requests with
the
queuing time and things like
that. So what you're saying is that let's model first how to write a page.
How to write a single page.
And so
the latency to write a single page, because
mm-hmm.
that itself we know is quite complex.
Yeah.
Right? There can be large variance.
I would like to propose this, right? Because I think we can go faster in at least in the right model. So I'm thinking that for at least for this part of the project, talking about the right model, we can meet more frequently, just to make progress fast in this part. I don't know what you guys think. At least for the right model, when we finish the right model. So we can think in new, I don't know, for instance, from today to the next meeting, we can think propose methods to model the merge part,
mm.
right? So we can next discuss that how can we model that.
Yeah.
But I think 1 week is too much time, probably we are delaying too much that discussion.
I'm willing to meet as frequently as you want. I have no problems. Except for this week, I'm away on Thursday and Friday.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Okay.
But from next week onwards, we can meet more frequently. And I think, but I think the key would be to have someone spend time working on the merge model, right? I mean, and the kind of things that we need to think about are, is it a partial merge or a full merge? And then start with the simpler case, maybe the partial merge, and then think about how to model the latency of the merge operation, depending on some model for number of valid blocks. If you know number of valid pages per block, then maybe you can model the merge cost in some way, right? And then assuming that you have number of valid pages per block, you can think about, well, how do I get the number of valid pages per block later on? Maybe the number of valid pages per block depends on other things like randomness of the workload and the prior state of the device, how much randomness there was in the writes and things like that.
So then what I can propose in that sense, that probably not just have one person, but let's do something like we can think in parallel, right?
Mm.
Trying to come up with a model, you know, try to think separately. And then
we can merge the two.
We can merge the two and discuss have a good, at least with the understanding we have so far, and have a good result.
Yeah, that's fine with me. You know, that's how Tauli was telling me that in Microsoft Research Asia, in China, in several labs, they have large armies of students. Then you have two groups of students working on exactly the same problem. They're basically competing against each other. Okay, who can come up with a better?
Okay.
You can do that here.
Yeah.
But I do see that it's certainly good to have two people think independently and come up with something maybe different.
Yeah, exactly.
And
that's the point.
And then you end up with something that's even better than what each person can come up with individually.
Yeah,
I agree.
That's the idea of multi-programming, actually. And like, I mean, having multiple threads of solving the same problem.
Yeah.
So if...
And whoever comes up with the answer first can preempt the other guys.
Well, no, it's not about, I mean, speed of the solution, right? But it's the more interesting part of that is that you have different points of view, and
mm-hmm.
it's unlikely that both teams or the multiple teams are going to make the same mistake.
Mm-hmm.
So if there are errors in the solution and you see uniform answers,
mm-hmm.
So that means that the solution is sound, in fact.
That's
but
assuming that the teacher taught them well. The teacher did a good job, then most students will get it right.
Uh-huh.
If not, then everyone will be wrong. No, I do see there are some interesting ideas, you know, work stealing and things like that in distributed
mm-hmm.
computing. That, so when do we meet next?
Well, I guess
same
thinking
time
about
next week,
yeah,
week.
Same
yeah.
time next week. Yeah, because I was thinking about something like Friday, but I forgot
that
you're gone.
I'm not here, unfortunately.
Yeah. So thank you. Okay. But let's try to think.